Can you hear me okay?
Splendid. I'll carry on anyway. This is a brief Accessibly Gaming History lucky dip. It's just a skipping stone across a sea of amazing work that's been going on since, well, in some ways since the 60s, maybe before. It's pretty much my second worst nightmare giving public speaking after doing it in Spider-Man pyjamas. So I've got a lot of slides to get through, but hopefully they'll show a lot of colour and an interesting bit of taste to some of this history. Yeah, basically, humans, animals, we've always played games to learn, to have fun, to sharpen abilities, to bond. This picture is from the 1800s, and this is some people playing games using undersea telegraph cables, which was bridging continents in the 1800s. And they make a move, and the move was translated via Morse code by a telegraph key operator, and they'd play games like that. Since the Middle Ages, people have played blind chess, pretty much just to show off how brilliant they were. this is going back to the earliest electronic games. This is an amusement arcade in London in the 1930s. This was the pretty much the height of the Great Economic Depression, and this was accessible entertainment for cheap. In the middle of this room is a Chicago exhibit rotary merchandiser. I list it because it's possibly the first electronic game of skill. And they still make these games today, but normally they've got zombies in for some reason. It's basically a rotating wheel. You'd have some prizes on it. You're very unlikely to win. And if you press a button, which was wheelchair height, coincidentally, or child height, you had a very small chance of knocking down, I don't know, some cigarettes or whatever to win, hopefully. There were games before this with electricity. They were electric shock machines. But I don't really think they were games. They were really just a test of how daft you were. That's a closer vision of it. And if you were lucky, you'd pop a prize down, open the drawer, and you'd take it away. This video is from about 1960. And this is not the birth of electronic assistive technology, but I think it was probably one of the most important moments in the history of it. And I'm just going to play the clip. No sound.
Oh, did you plug in the
sound
cable?
No. That would be ridiculously sensible. I've got one here. Okay. Sorry, apologies. It was always going to be a shambles. Oh, no, it's in. I'll try again. You were worrying about looking professional, Ian. Don't worry about it. I'm making you look good. Okay, let's try again. It's a bit wobbly.
You were hurt and were severely disabled. At the spinal injury stentoscope mandible, they've devised a POSSET, a system for people paralyzed except for the neck and head, providing a far more effective way of communication than this. The new system, financed by the Polio Research Fund, also uses the mouse, for nearly all paralyzed people retain the full use of their mouse. The simple principle is best illustrated by a mercury U-tube. By means of air pressure, the liquid is forced up, contact is made, the light goes on. Release the pressure, the liquid falls, breaking the contact. The principle is converted for use in electrical apparatus by means of a diaphragm-operated switch. By regulation, through gentle pressure or suction, patients can operate through a relay several different devices.
This is very early home assistive technology.
He can switch on the light. A telephone call requires a more sustained pump.
Ambassador, 1280, please.
It's amazing how many things are possible with this system, even fast typing. This is based on a grid card designed so that the letters most frequently used are the easiest to obtain. By sucking, the patient selects a column. By blowing, he picks out the particular letter he requires. The machine is fitted with a continuous roll of paper. Believe it or not, 100 words a minute are possible with a bit of puffing proficiency.
Possum did amazing things, and it's a company that still runs today. The equipment was available at the point of need from the NHS, and really the point was to get people home and living their lives rather than being confined to hospital beds. And it made a massive difference to people. People got jobs, they could communicate with their loved ones. There was a lady called Hilary Pohl, who had a condition where eventually all her muscles would just give way, and all she had was a flicker of movement in her toe, and it enabled her to compose some amazing poetry. She enjoyed writing reviews of cricket games and all sorts. Really amazing work back in the 60s. And by the 1960s, there were hundreds of computer games, but mostly they weren't accessible to the public. You had to be academic or scientific, government labs, things like this. And this clip shows a game called Gomoku, I believe, which is pretty much a match five in a row, and it's being played with a light pen in 1969.
Here, a group player is playing a computer which has only the simplest tactical knowledge of the game. The computer plays the cross-hatched counters.
This is a time when people were commonly quite terrified of computers, but that changed, mostly. 1972, this is a picture of a fairly conventional amusement arcade. There's a lot of pool tables full of pinball machines, and there's one solitary Pong machine that's just started to appear. And it was this television tennis at home and in the arcades from Magnavox and Atari that finally gave people a chance to play these games rather than, you know, having to be in academic circles and so on. And that's not to say that Pong wasn't an incredibly hard game for some people, but it was very popular because it was easy to grasp. Most people knew tennis. This is 1973. This is a flyer of handicap Pong, which is, as in a golf handicap, it was just a way of balancing the game. It was to give the game a bit of extra life, and you could, if I zoom in, you could make one paddle a lot bigger than the other, and that eventually took hold with all the home Pong clone machines. Where it was very, very common to get that ability to balance a game and make it fairer for one player than another. And yeah, it's quite tedious getting thrashed constantly by a bigger brother or bigger sister. So this stuff made a big difference. This is a Magnavox Odyssey. This picture's from 1973, and this is the Veterans Administration Prosthetic Center. Bioengineering Research Service, it was in New York and Miami, and these were for returning Vietnam veterans. And they were trying to find things that would keep them interested in life, and just good occupational therapy things. And this is a chin-mounted joystick. And there's a guy in a wheelchair playing against someone else. And I guess because he's unable to use the conventional controls, it made a huge difference. And this is a picture of a very common issue that hit most people in the 70s and 80s. it's a little girl unable to reach the controls or see the screen properly. And, you know, what disables people in games can hit a massive range of people. And if you can remove those barriers, it can make all the difference. 1978, this is one of the most important games, Space Invaders, if not the most important game. It just took the world by storm. Simple controls, one joystick and one button with the Japanese machines that made it around the world, three buttons with the American machines. This is an Invader house. These were very common apparently in Japan. And the picture just shows jammed in people, men and women, playing cocktail table Space Invaders machines, pretty much as far as you can see. Another picture jammed in. There's a cool Japanese Elvis guy in the corner. quite a rare colour picture. I'm just giving you know, this is obvious. Space Invaders was massive. And what's exciting when something comes out and it's new, everyone wants to play it, and a lot of people would find that they couldn't play it. I couldn't play it without my dad hoiking me up, which was quite uncomfortable because I couldn't see the bottom of the screen. But more so, if you couldn't manage the controls, you're cut out of the game and you're cut out of a massive cultural thing. This is a London picture, and there's a young guy who's staring quite lustfully in front of him. I'm not sure if it's at the woman or the Space Invaders machine that she's blocking. It's hard to tell. This is American Space Invaders. Just massive. I don't know if they look bored because this guy's really good at it. And they're just waiting for their turn. This is a massive Atari competition. This was put on by a company called Ingersoll in England. And just machines as far as the eye can see with kids playing. Again, this is a very well-known picture in geek circles. Okay. That's a guy called Robbie Marintz, and he and his brother set up some gaming competitions, sort of kind of esports, I suppose, in an early way. They were given machines by the massive names of the time, Stern, Atari, Williams, Taito in this picture, and he'd run a yearly competition. Often it was focused on pinball, but in this picture you can see it's the latest arcade games of the time. I think Stratovox he's playing, which is the first ever talking arcade game, or video arcade game. They did amazing things. His brother set him up with a whistle-controlled telephone and accessible satellite TV, and it was just, you know, opening the world back up again and giving him that power. He loved getting involved with this, and I believe it spread to certain other countries around the world. This is just a little picture of some kids in England on a very shaggy carpet. Just the electronic generation. It's been a long time that kids have been obsessed with electronic gadgets. This is Reg Malin, who you saw earlier in the Possum video, known for dancing eyebrows. And this is a view data system, which is early public internet, really. It was called Prestel in England, and he shared electronic control for the disabled. Absolute visionary and pioneer, Reg Malin. And how many people saw this, it's hard to say, but it ran for a few years, and it was that ease of access of information made a huge difference. This fascinates me. This the British government funded possibly the most accessible computer of the time, between about 77 and 81. It was called Mavis. The young girl in the picture, her name's Joanne, and she's controlling this computer in a suitcase. And the idea was that you could take it to school and do your schoolwork there with a scan and select system. But it also gave you the power to control toys like this toy train. These boys looking a bit fed up because they're not really getting a go. It was an incredible system. It had music creation, art, a variety of ways you could play it. It had games, and they did say in the write-up of the system that even for the kids who couldn't grasp the scan and select system, the games were still a way in, and it was a sort of universal way of having some fun independently. But it was £5,000, which was an enormous amount of money, and the government decided to put the money into the emerging 8-bit computers like Apple and BBC Micros and so on. This is just a quick picture of Educational Computing magazine. And pretty much as soon as teachers could get computers into school, there were visionaries who saw that they were useful. And if you make it fun and a game, it was a way in that would get the kids' interests very well. This is you could custom design the interface. Brain's gone blank, jet lag. This is Apple, massive for educational software. They really pushed it into schools, and there were quite a few user groups that would push and share information and knowledge, because that was the biggest barrier, I think, a lot of the times, is people didn't know where to find the stuff. So in small pockets, people were getting this information in the 80s. In the UK, the Trace Center of Wisconsin worked with Microsoft and Apple, I believe, and they started to add accessibility features like magnifiers, text-to-speech, and so on. So that came in the computers, which eventually, many, many years later, has made its way into consoles. So definitely consoles are a long way behind. This is an Apple II fitted with an amazing card called the Adaptive Firmware Card, and you could do some really, really clever things. This is being played with a single switch, and turns Ms. Pac-Man pretty much into a step time game. Wouldn't suit all games, but it opened up a world. And what this way had is it gave people access to standard games that everyone was playing, rather than custom things that the Mavis system had. I think it was definitely the right route to go. It just slowed things down. This is from 1985.
What is actually amazing about this computer game is that I'm controlling it with my eyes. The electrodes fitted on either side of my eyes are picking up the eye's electricity. If I move my eyes to the left, the frog moves to the left. If I move my eyes to the right, the frog moves to the right. And there we are, I've won that game. Researchers have already developed other methods of controlling computers by eye movement. However, this system is not only more accurate, it's cheaper. About £300 to modify this BBC Micro.
And eye-gaze technology, I believe, started with NASA, who were fearful that astronauts, if the spaceship went out of control into a spin, wouldn't be able to lift their hands up to press the controls. So they came up with an eye-gaze system, very similar to Possum Scan and Select, where they could take control of the craft again. But in the end, they found out it wasn't needed, and they gave the system away, and people were using eye-gaze-controlled wheelchairs in the 60s. Although I don't think they were hugely successful, and probably a bit scary when they went wrong. This is some touch games from Brilliant Computing in 1987. This is how I got into the field.
So virtually touchscreen is its immediacy. It's a very motivating tool, and people want to use it. It appeals to a wide age range.
Computers can help you achieve your aims and objectives, whether you are working in education, the health service, social services, or as a carer of a handicapped person. The technology can be a powerful tool in enabling the achievement of your current goals, as well as opening up a host of new opportunities. Given the right software and input devices, computers are capable of motivating people across the age and ability range. At their Dell child development unit, they use the touchscreen as their main input. Working with more handicapped teenagers, Redwood Croft School finds single switch inputs useful.
Yes, should we do another one? All right, then.
Joystick games is a hierarchy of games to play with a joystick. The simplest of the games is Mousetrap. The object of Mousetrap is to catch a mouse by operating the joystick in any direction. We can determine how large or small the mousetrap is. The larger the mousetrap, the easier it is to catch the mouse. So we wait until the mouse is under the trap and then we operate the joystick in any direction.
This is jumping back to about 1981-82. I believe this is the first accessible gaming controller advert. This was by a man called Ken Yankelevitz. It's called the fingertip controller. You can actually use it here. He designed this because his children broke the traditional Atari joysticks. They were a bit rough. And he took it to Atari and said, you know, this could be really good and there could be benefits for some disabled people. And you can use just a very light touch on all these. They're just standard arcade buttons. Atari didn't want to take it on, but they did refer people to Ken, who built a number of amazing controllers of all shapes and sizes. Here's a custom gigantic joystick to the side of the lady, I think on the left. I think they're playing bowling on the Atari VCS. He made some amazing controllers for people who could only use the head movement and their mouths as well.
Allow disabled people to play games on the Atari 2600. In addition to recreation, the games provide an opportunity for disabled people to socialize and even compete with non-disabled people. As games and controllers have grown more complex, the quad controller has adapted to suit the needs of people with limited or no use of their limbs. From virtual golf to modern warfare, the quad controller allows quadriplegic people to game on.
And that line from 1981 continues today. There's a controller called the Quad Stick that Fred Davison makes, and he's a genius.
Wow, disabled.
Oops, sorry. Interestingly, Atari openly encouraged people to mod the controllers. There used to be club magazines that you could get, and it was a quite well-known thing that you could do is convert a standard controller into a left-handed controller just by fiddling about with the wires. Because it only had one button on one side, it was very uncomfortable to use if you were left-handed. So there was a little bit of thought, and in those days, the controllers were very easy to modify. And there was a bit of a standard. Atari joysticks could be used on pretty much any machine, which would be lovely today. 5 minutes, okay. Right, I better crack on. This is a quick bit on Space Invaders, which there was a well-known cheat that was shown. This is a slow motion device to slow games down. These were quite common, Game Genies, action replay cartridges where you could give yourself infinite lives. Very rare, Nintendo made the NES hands-free controller, which would enable people to use their chin and sit puff, as you saw in the Possum stuff, to control the NES games.
Oh, it's out there.
Yeah, it's outside, you can have a look. We've got Todd Stablefelt's original controller, who's in most of the footage and pictures. This was me starting off near enough, building switch adapted Namco controllers and finding ways that people could control music and create music, play games. Namco did amazing stuff in the 90s. This is the barrier-free controller. They made communication devices as well, and they've even adapted arcade machines. This is a maximum tune machine, which has been made wheelchair accessible with full hand controls. This is a clip of a taiko drumming machine. This machine was lightened. And the gameplay is slowed down a lot. I better rattle on. I'll probably upload this, so the bits that you won't see today, that they'll be there. So if you go to One Switch and the blog, it'll be there when I get over my jet lag. This is a photo of Becky. She'd been quite ill in hospital, and her mum said she knew she was getting better when she was moaning and saying she wanted to play some games. And she's used a testing, a way of playing Minecraft using just her eyes. And this was supported when my friend and colleague Bill Donegan set it up from Special Effect. And Becky's brilliant at giving feedback and tweaking the stuff. So important to get people involved. This is Doha in Qatar. This is the Marder Centre, and this is a young lad using a blind accessible game of tennis using a Wii remote, and it just uses vibrations to make the game playable. This is pre-Wii, I believe, and it's a Japanese elderly people's home, and it's the physio benefits of moving and playing games to encourage people to do more. This is my friend Colin McDonald, and he's playing what's normally a very hard game, just using a single head switch. And Colin does a lot of work to make games more accessible with me. He can control the entire Xbox and PlayStation menu systems using just a head switch. And he does a lot of campaigning as well. He's a great guy. It was a massive effort to get this working, and it's not official, but there's a lot of hurdles you have to jump over sometimes. Here's Colin using Tekken with his friend. How long? 5 minutes? 10?
Hello. Let's play James Project in Japan. Our purpose is to share information from ideas. Come to play games. Who has physical disability like us. So today, we will introduce what we do in our project. This time, our project study thinking about how to play Nintendo Switch or PS4. He plays with I controls for a system as one switch and stick or mouse. It's difficult to reproduce or complicated movie, but it's enough to enjoy it. As you can see, we are trying to make I can do it through our project. We hope to enjoy our life through playing the game. If you're interested in that, please contact us. Thank you.
Okay, this is going to be a 1 minute data blast. You might want to play this back. The web stuff's great. Special features were brilliant with Atari. They do things like a single ghost game of Ms. Pac-Man, very important to think of people who, like the lady using a single switch. It's just nice to give them fun things to do with the games, even if they can't play the games. It used to be fun just to mess about with the sound effects. iRobot had an amazing thing where you could just play with the graphics. Open world games, really, really important. To give people something of the game is a great thing. It's good to think of not over berating players, on the, at least on the easiest level. That gets annoying. DDR, you could turn the booing off, which was great. Hearing, very important to have volume options. Sometimes the games are that's a bit much for some people. Closed captions, that's important. Colour-coded subtitles is important. Audio aids can be great to give people some idea of important sounds. There's some concentric circles there radiating out that gives you an idea if you can't hear it. Input, some controls are ridiculously complicated. EA, 20 seconds. sight stuff, Taito did some good stuff with colour blindness consideration. Sorry, that's gone.
I know.
High contrast stuff is really important. Shoot One Up was brilliant, did some dark options. VIC-20, you're doing really well. 1981, this was a VIC-20. That was speech accessible stuff. Oh, I can't show you that. Really, my main thing is labelling stuff. It's very hard to find accessibility information, and very few people do it. EA did it with the AllPlay system, which was brilliant, but that was only a year. My three wishes, yeah, I have to come back and look at that. And I was going to finish on Daniel Scott, who's brilliant, and a bit of the joy of gaming. That's it. Thank you.